The former director of public prosecutions has told this programme he wants to see a law which bans insults scrapped. I'll tell you about the law in a moment, but first let me give you some examples of how it's been used. In 2007, a 19-year-old teenager called Kyle Little was arrested and prosecuted for growling and barking at two Labradors as he walked past them. The dog's owner thought he was just being a daft lad, but two police officers arrested him for committing a public order offence. He was convicted of causing harassment, alarm or distress, and fined £50 and ordered to pay £150 in costs. His conviction was later overturned on appeal. In another case in 2005, a student from Oxford University was arrested for saying to a police officer, "Excuse me, do you realise your horse is gay?" He was said to have made homophobic comments that were deemed offensive to people passing by. Eventually, the Crown Prosecution Service said there wasn't enough evidence and decided to discontinue the case. A Leicestershire trader was arrested in 2005 for selling T-shirts bearing the words, and there is a swear word here, bearing the words "bollocks to Blair." He was never prosecuted. The law that police and prosecutors have used in those examples is Section 5 of the Public Order Act. It was introduced in 1986 by Margaret Thatcher's government following a rise in offensive chanting at football matches and the riots in Brixton and Toxteth. The law removed the requirement for any intention to cause a breach of the peace. Instead, insulting words or behaviour could be penalised if they were spoken within the hearing or sight of someone likely to be caused harassment, alarm or distress, regardless of whether it or not it did actually cause them alarm or distress. The former Director of Public Prosecutions, Ken MacDonald, who was in the role between 2003 and 2008, says he believes the word insulting should be removed from Section 5 and that it shouldn't be a crime to insult anybody, no matter how unpleasant the comments might be.
Well, the section also contains the words threatening and abusive. So behaviour which is threatening, abusive or insulting at present is unlawful. I think the problem with the word insulting is that it encourages the police and sometimes prosecutors to go after people who are being no more than rude or offensive. So, for example, the famous incident of the 14-year-old girl who was stopped by the police for standing outside a Scientology church carrying a banner saying Scientology is a cult. The young student who was arrested in Oxford for telling a policeman that his horse was gay. I mean, these may be bad jokes, they may be rude behaviour, but certainly in a democratic society, this sort of behaviour should not be criminal. People shouldn't be arrested, prosecuted, still less locked up for that sort of behaviour. I think the sort of behaviour that we really would want to stop is behaviour which is genuinely threatening, obviously, or behaviour which is genuinely abusive. And I think most of the cases which are prosecuted under the term insulting, in fact, consist of abusive behaviour and should be categorised as that. So I think it's really a free speech issue.
Mm. Is it partly down to an interpretation by police officers and the CPS of insulting and threatening?
Well, it can be, I think. The problem is that if a prosecutor or if a police officer is looking at behaviour and putting it into the context of those sorts of words, well, threatening behaviour, we can all understand. That's something that could be dangerous and for other people. Abusive behaviour is something that can cause real offence, perhaps provoke violence. But what's insulting behaviour and who's to judge an insult? I mean, one man's insult is another person's exercise of a strongly held opinion. So I think it's a term which is difficult for police officers and prosecutors to interpret consistently, and I think it leads to some of the sorts of cases that I know you'll be highlighting in the programme. It's interesting to point out that in Scotland they don't have that word in their law. Their law is restricted to threatening and abusive behaviour, and I'm not aware that causes the police or prosecutors in Scotland any problems. I think if we got rid of the word insulting, it would simply provide a better balance between public order and free speech.
One of the examples you just gave us was pursued by prosecutors when you were Director of Public Prosecutions.
Yeah.
There's also another example in 2007, again when you were the DPP, a 19-year-old called Kyle Little was arrested and prosecuted for growling and barking at two Labradors as he walked past them.
Yeah.
Could you not have done anything to stop those cases going forwards?
Well, I mean, the CPS prosecute over a million cases a year, and it's I'm afraid virtually inconceivable that a case of that sort would come to the attention of the DPP until after it had taken place and been reported in the newspapers. And I did, from time to time, remonstrate with prosecutors if I read about those sorts of cases in the newspapers. I mean, we put out guidance about how the law should be applied, and we stressed to prosecutors, as I know my successor does, the importance of free speech in a democratic society. But I think the problem is that if that word is in the legislation, and if police officers and prosecutors are preparing charges on the basis of that word, mistakes of that sort are going to be made. And that's really one of the strongest arguments, I think, for amending the law to make it less likely that cases of that sort are brought. I mean, the example you've just given of someone being arrested and prosecuted for barking at a dog is just preposterous.
But you know, the police officers involved in that case and the CPS officials involved in that case presumably were sensible, well-trained adults, yet they didn't think it was preposterous.
Well, you know, organisations are made up of human beings, and human beings make judgments, and sometimes they make the right judgment, and sometimes they make the wrong judgment. I mean, one of the things we need in the law is consistency, and I think it's precisely because the term insulting is so imprecise that you're going to get rogue decisions if legislation contains those sorts of terms. I mean, it's much more easy to recognise abusive behaviour or threatening behaviour. I think that there's going to be such a range of views about what constitutes an insult and what doesn't, that you're just going to get an application of the law that is inconsistent and which results in the sort of cases that you're highlighting. I mean, that's the argument in favour of reform.
In some of the cases we're talking about this morning, they never resulted in a conviction. Either they were acquitted or a case was thrown out. Could you argue that that shows the law is working?
Well, it's working to the extent that the final adjudication is the right one. But in the meantime, someone has been arrested, perhaps taken to a police station, charged with a criminal offence, having to go to court, perhaps you know, obviously stand in the dock, give evidence, be cross-examined, with all the stress that that involves. I don't think myself it's a complete answer to this problem to say that, oh, don't worry, because the magistrates, the juries will weed out the bad cases. We're talking here about cases which shouldn't be brought in the first place.
Let's continue our conversation about Section 5 of the Public Order Act. It talks about insulting, abusive or threatening behaviour. And we've just heard from the former Director of Public Prosecutions, who says he feels that the word insulting should be removed from this act. Section 5 was also used in 2011 in the case of Emdada Chowdhury, a member of Muslims Against Crusades. They burned poppies on Remembrance Day as a two-minute silence was being observed nearby by service personnel and their families. It also chanted slogans like "British soldiers burn in hell." He was convicted under Section 5 and fined £50. In October last year, the Home Office launched a consultation on the Public Order Act, including whether the word insulting strikes the right balance between freedom of expression and the right not to be harassed, alarmed or distressed. The consultation closed 4 months ago. The government has yet to set out its views. Let's talk to Dale McAlpine, a street preacher from Workington in Cumbria. He was held for several hours and charged with a Section 5 offence for saying homosexuality is a sin. He eventually received a settlement of £7,000 plus £10,000 in costs and a personal apology from the police. Hello, Mr. McAlpine.
Hello.
Also with us, hoteliers Ben and Sharon Vogelenzang, who were charged with breaching Section 5 for getting into a conversation with a Muslim guest about Islamic dress for women. They were found innocent after a judge said their accuser's evidence wasn't reliable. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning.
Also with us, John Cooper, who is a QC and doesn't believe the wording of Section 5 needs changing. Hello, Mr. Cooper.
Good morning to you.
Dale McAlpine, explain what happened to you.
Well, I set out one Tuesday morning in April of 2010 to exercise my right of freedom of speech and preach the gospel to shoppers in Workington. And during my time out there, I was approached by a PCSO who told me that if I said anything homophobic or racist, he would arrest me, have me arrested. And eventually, during that conversation, I told him that I do say from time to time that homosexuality is a sin, because that's in the Bible. That's what the Word of God says. And eventually I was surrounded by five members of the Cumbria police and arrested and, as you said, detained in a police cell for several hours. They were convinced that I'd offended people. They were convinced that offending people was against the law.
Right. But as you say, that where you said homosexuality was a sin was in a conversation with the police officers or the community support officers, rather than in the public preaching.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So you were held in a cell, and eventually what did happen?
Well, I was released, charged. I had to appear in court the following week where I pleaded not guilty. The Christian Institute appointed me a lawyer, and eventually the Crown Prosecution Service dropped the case, and as you said, I was awarded £7,000 compensation and £10,000 cost.
And the experience of being arrested, put in a cell, taken to a magistrate's court, what impact did that have on you?
Well, I've never been arrested in my life. I'd never seen the inside of a police cell before. I'd never had my fingerprints taken by the police, or DNA, or a record of being arrested. So now I can no longer say that I've never been arrested.
Sharon and Ben, tell us your experience.
We ran a small hotel. It had taken us about 17 years to build up a bit family business, and we looked after guests. 80% of our business came from a local hospital, and there were patients who were on a pain management course. To cut it short, we had a patient who'd stayed in the hotel for 4 weeks and had freedom to discuss and debate her own beliefs. She was a white converted Muslim lady, and on the last morning of her leaving, she wanted to engage in a conversation with us over her dress, because she'd come down wearing a hijab for the first time. We didn't have the time. We were busy looking after guests during the breakfast run, and we on the third occasion of entering in, or her trying to get us into conversation, she had made a comment about the fact that we were Christians and what she believed about Christians. We stopped and had a conversation with her, albeit just to disagree with her opinion about what the Bible said, and to question, or to say that we didn't understand. I personally couldn't understand why she'd want to convert to Muslim and wear the dress, and that was like a trigger that then set her off seeking for attention from other guests. We continued with the breakfast run. To cut a long story short, she left the hotel, and we thought that was all. You know, that we were surprised at the reaction, but after that, the following Monday morning, we had a phone call from the police to say that there'd been an official complaint against us, and we had to go down to the police station to be interviewed. We had to wait for about 3 weeks because the particular police officer was away. We didn't know what the outcome of that was going to be. We were both taken to the police, or we had to go to the police station on the 20th of April. We were interrogated, that's what it felt, for individually for the whole day nearly. And when we came out of the station and got back to the hotel, we were told that we'd have to wait to see what the outcome was. And we got back to our hotel, and my brother-in-law, who's the manager for us on that day, said that he'd had a phone call from the hospital, who were our main client, to say that they were withdrawing all the business from us because the police had told them not to investigate the complaint until they'd finished their investigation. We had to wait until the July to then get a phone call to say we needed to go down to the police station and be arrested. We struggled to keep the business going. We had to lay off loyal, faithful staff at the end of May because we couldn't keep going. We were arrested in the July, and then the trial didn't take place until the December. So the whole experience was completely traumatic and just devastating to us as a, you know, personally and as a business. Mm.
So you were charged with breaching Section 5, and you were found innocent after
yes.
a judge said that your accuser's evidence wasn't reliable.
Unreliable,
right.
Yes.
So Who do you blame for you ending up in that situation? Is it, what do you blame? Is it the law? Is it the individual who made the complaint against you? Is it the police, the CPS, for taking the case forward?
We don't blame the individual who made the complaint, because she actually said at one point that she didn't want to go to court. And we just put it down to a misunderstanding or misinterpretation on behalf of the police and the Crown Prosecution, because they made the final decision. And even after the case was dismissed, after the trauma, the police said they would still take the same action, you know, in the same circumstances. So the law definitely needs to be changed.
John Cooper, QC, you don't think the law needs to be changed, but tell us how you react to both of the cases we've just highlighted here.
Well, I'm very sad to hear the facts of those cases, and I can quite understand both of your correspondents being very upset and angry about what happened. But what it reflects is bad decision-making by the police, bad decision-making by the Crown Prosecution Service. I was listening to your very interesting piece from Ken MacDonald, who I respect and admire a lot, talking on the abolition of this particular statute. Mm. But what he seems to be saying is that he wants the law amended to prevent people making mistakes. He made it pretty clear that his view was that rogue decisions were a good reason for changing the law. I differ with Ken on that one. If there are rogue decisions, as he put them, if there are bad decisions being made, as clearly they were in the case of the people that are talking on your programme now, it's not necessarily the law that needs to be changed, it's the training, common sense and behaviour of those that are interpreting the law. And so what I say is, it's not the law, it's the people who are interpreting the law.
But what would be detrimental about taking the word insulting out of this? So abusive and threatening behaviour would remain, but you would remove the word insulting, which is what Ken MacDonald is suggesting.
I understand. I mean, for many people, articulate people, strong-willed people, people who are used, for instance, to speaking in public or being in public or talking to the public, maybe insulting might not affect them. But there are vulnerable members of the community as well, and this section has been used and properly used in the past, for instance, to protect insulting words and behaviour being used outside elderly people's homes, where elderly people became distressed. Well, I've been told, by the way, by your producers, I could be very limited as to the exact words I can use on your programme.
No, not at all. I mean, as long as you don't swear.
Really? Oh, fair enough. Well, I was told I can use the W word, which I'm told people will understand what that means.
Yeah.
Being used, for instance, outside residences, elderly people's residences.
But that would come under abusive behaviour, wouldn't it?
In actual fact, the term was used as an insulting word in behaviour, used in the context of this particular case, in that it was used to insult directly people.
Yeah, what's the difference between insulting and abusive?
Well, as far as insulting is concerned, it's a direct attack on an individual in the presence or the perceived presence of a group of people. And it can be, for instance, used to insult an individual directly. It also can be used to insult an individual, not necessarily directly, but within a group of people. Mm. It's there to protect, it's there to add the power to the law enforcement agencies. But I'd emphasise this, these sections are there to give powers to law enforcement agencies. We must rely on discretion and common sense when they're used. There are a lot of laws in this country that, if they are misinterpreted by the CPS and the police, as they have been in the past, and there are other laws as well that have been misinterpreted and misused by the CPS and the police in the past, that can bring these laws into disrepute. Properly interpreted, it's a useful tool, but it needs to be properly interpreted.
Do you have some other examples where you say keeping this word insulting in Section 5 is a good thing?
Yes, well, let me use an example, for instance, of a case that was a few years ago. There was an individual, in fact from an evangelical Christian preacher, who carried a large placard bearing the words "Stop Immorality, Stop Homosexuality, Stop Lesbianism." And again, it was considered that it insulted and distressed, so the court said, a large crowd which had gathered. Now, the important thing about that case, as an example, is that the court did take into account people's rights of freedom of speech. There Article 10 rights, for instance, and indeed Article 9 rights. But the court said on balance that there has to be a balance of freedoms, and a balance not to be insulted in the context of the debate we're having must go alongside a balance of freedom of speech. And in that particular case, the courts held the individual guilty because they'd crossed over that balance. But let me use another example where the law was misapplied. It was misapplied, for instance, and badly misapplied in a case where a police officer, and the heights are important here, bear with me on this one, mm-hmm. the person who apparently insulted the police officer was a young lad, height 4'9", insulting a police officer, height 6 foot and weighing 7 stone. That particular young lad made a masturbatory hand gesture, as the courts very carefully describe it, and used the so-called W word. Mm. The magistrates convicted, with the Court of Appeal overturned. Now, that was an example where the courts are saying, for instance, that was an overuse of the law, and it was misapplied. And that's the key here, in my view, with the misapplication of the law.
What a waste of taxpayers' money.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree. But I emphasise again, you could say that, for instance, with a lot of laws that are broken, or perceivably broken, and then they're brought to court to find that they've not been broken. It's not the law, as I say. It's the application of the law. And you could say, for instance, every time a person is acquitted, what a bad use of taxpayers' money. I would say it's a good example of the courts working. It's a shame the courts were actually brought into play, I have to say, because they should never have been seized of the matter in the first place.
Dale, and indeed Sharon and Ben, Dale, your case was overturned on appeal. Sharon and Ben, you were found innocent by the end of your trial. Could you argue that actually, in the end, the law was effective and robust because, although you were arrested and charged and so on, the right decision was made in the end?
Well, definitely not. The fact that I was awarded £7,000 and £10,000 costs at taxpayers' expense was evidence that it was a wrong decision. And any law that which makes people, decent people, afraid to speak their minds needs changing.
In our situation, definitely not, because we had taken 17 years to build up a business. We lost our business immediately. 10 people lost their jobs. My sister and her family were made homeless. And we have been to, we've tried to sell our property. We've been to court for repossession. And we're still struggling today to try and start afresh and make jobs for ourselves. But and it
Sharon,
definitely should not have happened.
The judge in your trial decided that your accuser's evidence was not reliable enough for prosecution.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So why is your issue with the law rather than that individual who made those accusations against you?
Because the people who took it to court were the police and the Crown Prosecution, and the evidence that came out, there were three conflicting stories they'd used in the evidence. They didn't study the evidence that were given. The testimonies were completely incompatible and ludicrous. Mm. And it just wasn't just that we should be put through that situation because of that.
May I say, I absolutely agree with that last comment. Mm. Absolutely agree. It was the analysis of the evidence, it was the analysis of the case, that any individual applying common sense and even a modicum of an understanding of the law wouldn't have put the people that are talking now through the process they went through. But I emphasise again, everyone seems to be saying in this debate, I think, I might be wrong, everyone seems to be saying it's the decision-making process that dragged these poor people through the courts where they really should have no place.
Well, I think, Sharon, you're saying that the insulting bit should be removed from Section 5, are you?
Completely.
And Dale?
Absolutely.
Yeah. OK, let's hear Matt in London. Matt, thanks for contacting us. You are a stand-up, and every night you insult people, presumably,
yeah.
Most nights, particularly at the weekends at comedy clubs. What do you think of this bit of Section 5? The wording is insulting, threatening or abusive behaviour. And people like Ken McDonald, the former Director of Public Prosecutions, are suggesting that the insulting bit should be taken out because that's the bit that's misapplied, as John Cooper described it. What do you think?
Yeah, I do stand up pretty much 4 times a week in the evenings, and insult is kind of part of the comedy process, both from the audience and from the comedian. And so if you remove that, it would take the heart out of comedy. But also, just on a general level, I kind of think insult is a part of life.
Yeah.
We get insulted. And also, it's very hard to say people get insulted. You know, people get insulted the smallest thing and also the biggest thing. They don't get insulted. It seems like it's a huge spectrum. Mm. But I would think you could prosecute, if you went to any stand-up club any time, you could prosecute at least pretty much all the comedians, certainly several.
No, but you couldn't, because the audience, because of the very nature of the audience, they're not likely to be alarmed, harassed or distressed.
They are, because they go to a comedy club. You can't write everything. You know, when somebody goes to a comedy club, whatever their expectations are, there's expectations in their head.
Mm.
So people come to a comedy club and they are insulted. I know there's several comedians.
Common sense has been used. I mean, this Section 5 has been in since 1986. Have you ever been prosecuted?
No, I haven't, but I don't think everyone's aware of it. Like, I wasn't aware of it. I think there's definitely... I know there's been several people who've come to a comedy club and have left feeling very insulted and very angry, and they've complained to the promoter, let's say, or complained to the club, but I don't think they've been aware of this law.
So had they been aware, do you think they would have called the police? Seriously?
I think it's possible, yeah. I do think it's possible.
And do you think the police officer or whoever answered the phone would have laughed down the phone when they told them I was at a comedy night?
I don't... Well, if people are getting prosecuted for barking at dogs and saying Scientology is a cult... Mm. I mean, why not? Yeah. I mean, it seems like it does seem like a crime. I wasn't aware of the law until I heard your radio program. I wasn't aware it actually was against the law to be insulting. I mean,
I can imagine now, when I say it's got, as a joke, a lot of stand-ups now using the law in their favour, because I've seen a few get insulted from the audience.
Mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to change your routine, though, are you, Matt?
I'm not planning to.
No.
I'm just hoping I never get prosecuted.
Yes.
It's basically, you know, it's basically... I can't actually hear what the other people are saying in your programme, but...
Okay, I apologise for that. Sorry about the technical side of things. But you... Let's imagine a scenario where a member of the audience is particularly insulted by something that you've said and felt harassed or alarmed and contacted the police. You'd have to... I mean, you'd have to trust the police and the CPS to use common sense, would you not?
Well, I don't know, because sometimes I haven't. I mean, I have insulted people. Mm. I mean,
Can you give us an example without swearing, obviously?
Well, obviously, I mean, from the very basic level to you take a look at somebody wearing a particular shirt, or, I mean, even where... I mean, I try to be kind to the audience and try to make it friendly, and I take the look at myself as much as anybody else.
Okay.
But somebody... It does sometimes happen that you take the look at somebody's a particular body or face or clothes or... where they speak, or their background, and sometimes it does get heated. Swear words are used. I mean, the C word is used every night, every comedy club I ever go to. The C word, if somebody's talking to the audience, you know, when they shouldn't be talking, the comedian will normally swear at them. It's normally done, normally gets a laugh, but often it is, you know, it is a swear word being used at them.
Okay. Thank you, Matt. Thank you very much.
All right,
Mr. Cooper, thank you for coming on the programme this morning. We're going to talk to more of our listeners throughout the rest of the programme. Del McCampine, thank you for your time as well. And Sharon and Ben, thanks for coming on the programme.